1989, the main stage was Tiananmen Square in front of the Forbidden City in Beijing. Every day, you could just watch the most extraordinary things happen for 7 weeks. You know, a million people all protesting against their government. Most people who'd had a little experience were fearful that there would be a response, and a brutal response, because they couldn't imagine that this Leninist one-party state would just say, all right, well, you know, game's over, we give up. And they didn't give up. And they killed untold numbers of people. The party reinstated itself, and it's still in power. Xi Jinping, when he was a young kid, he learned early on that to survive, you have to become more red, more Leninist than anybody. Because if your father's a counter-revolutionary, you'll never be accepted completely. So you have to demonstrate your utter and total and excessive loyalty to the party, or you too will be cast out.
Very few people have the breadth of experience with China in a real life way as you do, certainly in America. And I wanted to start with, if you're open to it, having you share the story of how you first went to China, which I believe was in the mid-70s, 1974, if I believe I have the date correct. I'd love for the audience to understand your fascination with that country and what you remember about going there for the first time 50 years ago.
Yes. Well, my first trip was early in 1975 when Mao was still alive and the Cultural Revolution was still going. But it was sort of keyed up years before that. And I think paradoxically, my fascination with China, which really began in the early 1960s, late 1950s, was precisely because you couldn't go there. So I think I always, and indeed I wrote a whole book about this because it fascinated me about explorers of sort of the early 20th century, late 19th century, you know, who were constantly trying to get to Mecca or Lhasa or the Amazon or the headwaters of the Nile. I think it was precisely because it was unexplored, it was inaccessible, and in certain regards, people didn't want you there. So I think the allure of being rebuked, because in those days, my passport said in giant black bold letters, not good for travel in the People's Republic of China. So I kind of fell into China at college, taking this sort of accidentally, I should say, legendary course that met 3-4 times a week and very sort of intense, went through all of Chinese and Japanese history. And I kind of never got unstuck from it. So it was the decade that I spent. I had to go to Taiwan at first to learn Chinese, and I hovered all around the borders, dropping in at Chinese embassies to see if there wasn't some way to penetrate this sort of veiled, cloistered, inaccessible revolution that Mao was conducting. And I spent 2 years in Indonesia and covered the war in Indochina. I went to Cambodia, all of these places, but it was peripheral. So when I had a chance finally to go, it was in those days, the only people who were really welcomed were people sponsored by fellow travelers, other, quote, friendly people, leftists. So I got invited, and I think they may have regretted it afterwards, to go on a trip of, it was called a Qingyan Lao Dong Tuan, a youth work brigade. And we went for several months and worked on a model agricultural brigade, a very famous one called Dajai that was in Shanxi province, very near, I should say, where Xi Jinping went to rusticate for his 7 years during the Cultural Revolution. And then we worked in a Shanghai electrical machinery factory. And at that point, I was covering the trip for the New Yorker. And when the Chinese hosts learned that I would be writing, there was tremendous sort of upset and concern. And we were living in caves similar to the ones that Xi Jinping lived in and Mao Zedong lived in. It was in the northwest Shanxi province. I got locked up in my cave for a few days while the comrades sort of ruminated on what do we do with this guy, Shell, who's here as a leftist youth, which wasn't exactly a leftist youth. I was a youth, but writing for the New Yorker magazine, this wasn't in the program. So it was a very confusing, strange trip, 1975, and had to go to lots of study sessions, study Mao Zedong's thought and to criticize Lin Biao, who had just tried to assassinate now, or criticize Confucius, who was actually Zhou Enlai. So it was a very weird trip trying to make sense out of this tectonic epic revolution that Mao was leading that we could only sort of see from the outside, even though we were inside. And what sense to make out of it was very hard to kind of be sure of how to analyze it. And of course, I was there with some people who were trying to, quote, build friendship of the leftist persuasion. And that wasn't my brief. I was there to look and ask questions so that I was a bit of a skunk at the picnic. But it was a very important trip because it meant that I got to see China during its more extreme period under Mao. So that when things started changing later on under Deng Xiaoping, which is very surprising, I had a goalpost firmly anchored down to the Maoist Cultural Revolution side, and I could judge the changes, which were all the more astounding to me because of that.
Hmm. I don't know if you had a strong sense of what you would find when you finally got into this country that was so difficult for non-Chinese to enter at that period of history. What do you remember discovering that is still resonant with you, that is interesting or was in line with what we now know about the Cultural Revolution? You said you were a skunk at the party. What do you remember witnessing and observing that stays with you?
Well, when I say I was a skunk at the picnic, I think it was precisely because I was curious and wanted to ask questions and not just gloss over things. You know, for instance, we would go visit a prison. I remember wanting to know were there counter-revolutionary political prisoners there. Well, that wasn't a friendly question. There were many things like that, which was quite confusing to me because while I was very curious about Mao's revolution, namely to kind of ascertain, did it work? Was it possible to create a new man? Was it possible for an old class system that had lasted for millennia to be overthrown? And how did people lead their private lives in this very public revolution? All these things were very, very interesting to me. And it was very hard to get answers. And it was very hard to actually see, because even if you were there and spoke some Chinese, as I did, because I'd been in Taiwan for almost 2 years, it was very hard to have any interaction with anybody that was meaningful, because people were frightened. But it wasn't clear at that moment to us, I think, what were they afraid of? What was real? What was unreal? What was a Potemkin village? What was not? And so we were sort of trying to peer through the darkness to see kind of what was going on. So I think it was, but it was, in retrospect, I think I understand it much more completely that there was very difficult, particularly for intellectuals or educated people or anybody, to speak freely because there was an orthodoxy. And to stray off the orthodoxy could generate dire consequences for someone. So in a certain sense, one can understand why someone like myself, who was kind of probing and wanting to be more spontaneous and get answers to questions, might create something of an allergic reaction.
And to your point, as you reflect on this now, or as you were reflecting on it later in your life, the fear that you feel like you experience in interacting with people who live there, what was the source of that fear? Why were people so scared at that time that you think was probably legitimate? If you think that's the case, why were people so terrified at that time?
Well, the consequences of having independent views or having any kind of independent loyalty, whether it was to a parent, a sibling, a lover, a friend, a wife, a child, these were antithetical to the notion that almost all primary loyalty should go to the party and Mao Zedong. So this created a climate in which people felt extremely anxious and nervous about saying anything which might color their sort of political character in a way that would get them in trouble. So the best reaction was to say nothing, to kind of just go silent, just to be obedient. I think one of the things the party has long excelled in is it doesn't mind corruption, you know, it doesn't mind malfeasance in office, it doesn't mind, you know, people with sexual peccadilloes, mistresses, you know, Gucci handbags. That doesn't bother it as much as disobedience. And disobedience is not simply to do what you're told, but to think what you're told, and not express errant views or independent thinking. So I think, although it's difficult for me to fully understand what I was experiencing at the moment when the Cultural Revolution was still going on, as I look back on it now, it was extremely important because it was the beginning of a fund of experience that helped explain later on exactly what the nature of the revolution was and how incredibly controlling and intolerant it was of any kind of open discourse, free speech, even to the point, and I found this a very interesting subject, of how did one make friendships in a climate like that? Because friendship was a word the party had hijacked. You know, they had friendship associations, they had friendship activities, but this was kind of Potemkin friendship. But real friendship means that you're loyal to the other person primarily, not to your boss, not to the party, not to some. So, and how did people fall in love in a situation like that? Because in a certain way, and this became very evident to me later on because I married a Chinese woman, you know, even love was a kind of an insubordinate act. Because what it bespoke of, that you were bonding with a higher kind of loyalty to an individual, and the individual didn't count. What counted was the collective and the party and the revolution. So all of these questions were ones that I still find very interesting, and indeed wrote a whole novel finally called My Home, about a classical musician who goes home to China in the early 50s and of course runs into terrible, dire circumstances and gets his hands chopped with a meat cleaver by Red Guards and can never play the piano again because he had this sort of other kind of loyalty. He was religious and he was a musician. So these were questions which I think that's what made China interesting for me as much as the political lines and who was in power and what was the economic policy. That was interesting too. But whether it was actually possible to re-engineer human experience and human relationships, this was the fundament of Marxism-Leninism, as Stalin conveyed it and ultimately as Mao Zedong reinterpreted it in an even more extreme form.
Yeah. I think it might be helpful. I think a lot of people who will listen and watch this will be familiar with the Cultural Revolution and with Mao, but it might be helpful to back up for a second and give you some space to detail what that experience was, what the goal of the Cultural Revolution was, and who Mao was, what we now know about that man, and maybe what you knew about him prior to going to China for the first time.
Well, Mao Zedong is a very interesting man, a smart man. He actually wrote quite well and wrote a whole corpus of theoretical essays, which were quite astute. Had good poetry, had good calligraphy. Actually grew up at the very end of sort of the era of traditional culture in China in the late 19th century. But he had a terrible relationship with his father. And he was constantly struggling with him. And I think out of this struggle came his notion of the importance of struggle, of violence, of radical overturning of things. Because in a sense, I think what he was trying to do was to overturn his father, the tyranny of his father. And so that he, in certain ways, I think, sort of without quite understanding what he was doing, because these were sort of psychological mechanisms as much as intellectual, he transferred some of those understandings that he from his relation with his parents to society. And he viewed China as weak because of its traditional society, its traditional values, Confucianism and the landlord gentry class, the hierarchies of Confucianism that were expressed within the dynastic system. And so all of these things made him deeply vulnerable to the idea that China needed to be overthrown. So he had an expression in Chinese, if you don't destroy, you can't create. And he also loved this Monkey King from Journey of the West, whose adage was Don Ao Tin Kong, make great disorder under heaven. So it was these sort of, what are they? They're kind of inclinations that lay behind Mao's sort of massively disruptive and destructive cultural revolution, which was basically consecrated to having classes overthrow the existing, the bourgeoisie were going to be overthrown by the proletariat. And it didn't matter if you had to kill them all. You know, they killed a million landlords, no problem. Mao saw the necessity of radical and violent struggle and change. That was his revolutionary prescription. So the Cultural Revolution sort of grew out of that sentiment. And then Mao had kind of gotten himself into a corner. He had communized agriculture. I mean, you have to remember, China was a million little villages scattered all around this vast country, all very separate. And Mao put them all into a box, into communization, took away their cows, their ox, their goat, their chickens, their patches of vegetables, and collectivized them. And out of that, in 1959 and 60, came a massive famine, where 30 to 40 million people were killed. And so the leadership, people like Deng Xiaoping and Zhou Enlai, who were more realistic, sort of managed to push Mao aside. And the way he came back was to be the big leader, almost like an emperor, the charismatic sort of Mussolini, Hitler type of big leader, and launched the Cultural Revolution and locked up all of these other guys who were a little more pragmatic and a little more practical. And for 10 years, China went on this tear of overthrowing the revolutionary, counter-revolutionary classes. And this, by the way, is where Xi Jinping's father, Xi Zhongxin, who was a reasonable man, grew up in the revolution and was vice premier. He got cashiered as a counter-revolutionary because his views were not in complete concord with Mao's extremism. And so she grew up with that, with a father who was a counter-revolutionary. So the Cultural Revolution was this period, I think, really unequaled in modern history, where one class or classes turn on each other. Leaders turn on each other. Everybody turns on everybody. And Mao believed there were two kinds of contradictions, an antagonistic one where you had to fight, struggle, and kill, or a non-antagonistic one where you could talk things out. But an awful lot of the contradictions in Mao's view were antagonistic. There was no way to resolve them short of extermination. Extirpate your foe.
Hmm. You use the word Confucianism in describing some of its influence on historic China. And I think a lot of people that will come across this will be familiar with the Chinese Communist Party and its role in the last 70, 80 years in China. I'd love to give you some space to talk about what preceded the Communist Revolution and any historical context that you think it helps explain China to a general audience, whether that's related to Confucianism or other aspects that preceded the modern communist China that we're familiar with. What came before that that is important and fascinating and just relevant for people to know about?
So what came before the revolution and also before the Republican period when Chiang Kai-shek was leading and Sun Yat-sen was a kind of an endless cycle of dynasties that lasted, you know, from BC all the way up to the 20th century when the last dynasty was overthrown in 1911, 1912. And there were two trends that were very interesting there. One was Confucianism, which was quite ethical, very hierarchical, you know, not a bad credo, but it was quite conservative. But there was another tradition too, which people know less about and speak less about. It was called legalism, fajia, and it was very, very different from Confucianism. Confucius believed that if a good leader, you know, an ethical, moral leader, reigned, it would be like a gentle wind blowing the rice seedlings. He said they would bend willingly before the goodness of that leader. Legalism was, okay, here's the list of things you shouldn't do, and if you do them, here are the punishments. Extremely draconian. So these two traditions kind of danced their way down through the dynastic period. We hear a lot about Confucianism, less about legalism, but interestingly enough, Mao Zedong, the first essay he ever wrote, I think it was about 1911, was about one of the avatars of legalism, this kind of very draconian despot, the Shangyang. So it was telling that Mao was drawn to that kind of despotism. And I should also say he and his whole generation, the May 4th movement up through teens and 20s, very much identified China's weakness and its inability to defend itself against the West with Confucianism, with the old Confucian and other kinds of culture, Buddhism, Taoism, but the whole, they called it the four olds, and they wanted to destroy it. Because if China was going to be strong, it needed to reinvent itself. And they saw traditional culture as the source of its weakness. The problem was, and here Mao was a walking contradiction himself, but so was his whole generation. They grew up in that culture. They loved that culture. They spoke that language. They read those books. They autonomically responded like traditional Chinese people. And yet they wanted to be modern, and they identified modernity with overthrowing their own past and adopting more Western, enlightened, rational ways. But you have to remember that there's a tremendous cost when you turn on your own culture. In a sense, you hate yourself. You hate what your own nation is, your own cultural sort of patrimony. So this created massive contradictions and people like Mao were extremely traditional. He never could stop writing poetry in classical form. He never could stop reading the great old novels of classical time. So these guys were really, really in a contradiction, but they couldn't acknowledge it.
Fascinating. How do you explain the appeal of a total wholesale cultural overthrow, the appeal of Marxist-Leninism to figures like Mao and the other revolutionaries who teamed up with him? What, in your assessment, are the best explanations as to why that philosophy, why that political system, that social system convinced these men to devote their entire lives to its implementation in China?
I think here, in explaining the answer to your question, it's important to remember the word humiliation, which is something that for the last 100-odd years has been a recurring theme in Chinese history. The humiliation of what was considered not only a great culture, but the center of the universe, is insofar as China understood there was a universe. They knew nothing about Europe or Africa. It was just China, and it was the center, literally the central kingdom, as the name China suggests. And so when Westerners started arriving to trade with their gunboats, and you ended up with all these wars, the Opium Wars, and, grabbing colonies, the Portuguese in Macau, the British in Hong Kong, and concessions throughout China. This was a period of immense sort of a humiliating period where the greatness of China seemed to be dismembered and nobody could do anything about it. They just had to accept it. And this is, by the way, what made China so vulnerable to Leninism, because of its notions of imperialism suggested that China was being unfairly imperialized by capitalists trying to extend their own, sort of capitalist system by spreading it around the world and having a colonial state. So I think China, and it continues today with Xi Jinping, has a deep inferiority complex. A, about the inadequacy of its own culture to defend itself. B, about the fact they attacked their own culture because it couldn't defend China. And C, China was a sick man of Asia. Now, even after it ceases to be that and it's become a great power, there's that lingering historical fixation on the narrative of victimization and humiliation. And this is what inspires, I think, Xi Jinping's nationalism, patriotism, and the endless sort of tropes about China will never submit to this, to that, to the other. This tremendous sensitivity to Western dominance and the ideas that the old, quote, great powers still get to set the terms of the game. Interestingly enough, Chiang Kai-shek shared the same sentiment. He too spoke endlessly about the humiliation of the unequal treaties and of Shanghai and foreign concessions and Hong Kong and all of these other things. So it's something that was deep in the bones of Chinese of all kinds, that having figured out that, they wanted a restoration of greatness. And this is exactly what Xi Jinping is proclaiming that he will provide them, rejuvenation, to vault over this period of victimization and humiliation. But finally, this is not a political problem. This is a psychological problem. It's a mindset. It's deep in the soul, not just of the culture, but the leaders. So Just like people who in America were born in the Depression and they never can make enough money because they grew up in penury. Well, it's, I think, in many ways similar in China. No matter how much power Xi Jinping accrues, it's never enough because you never can feel safe enough and protected enough in a world out there where there are all sorts of challenges and threats and competition.
I'd love to get back to your story and move the conversation to the mid-1970s and to get your memory and, you know, historical knowledge about the state of China at that time, including its GDP and its just how poor the country was at that time. And also something that I think for, you know, especially young people probably seems unfathomable, which is, you mentioned this earlier in the conversation, how it was a closed system that you couldn't get in. And I'd love to give you some space to tell that story as well about how China slowly began to reopen. It's an incredible trajectory from 50 years ago to now, where it's a rival of the United States. But I'd love to go back to that mid-70s time period and give some context as to what China, the state of China at that time, and how this vast nation began to open itself to the rest of the world.
Well, if you had asked me when I came out in 1975 and wrote, I don't know, it was a 3, 4, 5-part series for The New Yorker, I can't even remember. That was back in the day when they would run these endless pieces. If I had seen any intimation that China would change, I would have thought you mad. It seemed this was China. Mao Zedong's China was China, and it was going to be et aeternam. And this is, I think, one of the most important lessons that I learned in the following years after that first trip, is that China has many, many sort of aquifers of influence sort of that you can't see underground. And at different times, different wellsprings pop up to irrigate it with different sentiments, different intellectual views, different political views. So then, you know, it wasn't so many years. Mao Zedong died in 1976. Mao Zedong was hardly gone when, you know, Deng Xiaoping suddenly was thrust back up on the stage, having been pilloried and sent down and mocked and delivered. If you want to have a really terrifying experience, go read Deng Xiaoping's confession during the Cultural Revolution about all the ways he failed to serve Mao Zedong. And you realize everybody was sort of stuck with this guy and had to be obedient or get crushed. So there, suddenly, Deng Xiaoping comes back. And this country, which we'd thought was sort of stuck forever in Maoist revolution, begins in the most dramatic ways to begin to change. And I mean, I remember going back, and the first democracy wall popped up in 1978. And this was a wall around a car barn on Xidan, which is the sort of the western part of the Avenue of Eternal Peace, where people just sort of innocently started pasting up essays on paper, white paper written, you know, hand in characters. And then they started coming and giving speeches. And this turned into a kind of a festival of free speech and openness. And at that point, Deng Xiaoping even supported it because he was still trying to get rid of the Maoists. Well, if you were down there as I was, you're just scratching your head saying, what is going on here? And that was just the beginning. So it went on from there. And, you know, during the 1980s, which are one of the most extraordinary periods, I think that, you know, as a writer, I've experienced, of course, ending in 1989, when this country was reinventing itself in myriad ways, and the leaders had had enough of the Cultural Revolution. Mao is gone, and they were trying to reform it. Where was it going? Nobody knew. Was the party going to be reformed out of existence? It was possible to imagine. Yes. And so we watched with just stupefaction as publishing began to spring to life. You know, I remember when there was a women's bodybuilding competition popped up down at Canton, you know, almost naked women bodybuilding. I mean, this was unthinkable under Mao. There were horse racing tracks started to be built. There was a, remember going out once, there was a place where you could go outside of Beijing and you could shoot rockets and mortars and 50 caliber machine guns. And, you know, it was sponsored by the military to make money. Everybody wanted to make money. And you go out there and blow things up for the day and, you know, all good. But you just came back saying, what? What's going on here? So we watched this happening bit by bit by bit, and the world should forgive those of us who were chronicling it as writers and scholars and journalists if we wondered whether this momentum might take China completely out of its revolutionary mode. But it didn't. And I remember looking back now, 1979, Deng Xiaoping reminded everybody that even though he was initiating these, what he called reform and opening, and of course it was opening to the world too, there were the four basic principles, which all were very clear, that loyalty to the party remained. The party remained central. This wasn't going to be turned into a multi-party system, but there could be a great sort of liberation in thinking and exchanging of ideas, and in newspapers, magazines, television, all of this could open up, but could not threaten the primacy of the party itself.
Hmm. And as you look back on that time, you know, the 1980s to now, and I know this is a very complicated question, but the best explanation, you know, you have come to believe as to why it didn't, the country generally didn't take another direction towards the freedoms that seemed to be nascent, and there were embers of, you know, what we would recognize as, you know, general freedoms for its people. How do you explain that? What is your best conclusion as to the reason or reasons why China has stayed a one-party state and has not evolved into something that, understandably, journalists and academics and scholars like yourself were probably quite excited by the prospect of it becoming?
Well, I think, interestingly enough, you know, in the 1920s, when both the Communist Party, it was formed in 1921, and the Nationalist Party of Sun Yat-sen and Chiang Kai-shek borrowed Leninism from Russia because they felt China was weak and their parties were poorly structured and weak. So they had all these advisors from the Comintern come and teach them how to build strong parties and nationalist parties and disciplined parties. And that's what, of course, Leninism is all about, is not only imperialism, but how do you build a strong party establishment? So both the communists and Chiang Kai-shek's nationalists built Leninist parties. And I think most people in China thought this is what China needed, a strong leadership. You couldn't just throw the door open. When Sun Yat-sen tried that in 1912, have a Republican China with his Three People's Principle, it lasted 45 days. And then some guy, Yuan Shikai up in the north, usurped him to become an emperor again. He didn't last long, but. So I think both, there was that strong inclination in both of the competing parties to have strong leadership, which is part of the whole Leninist system. And as that got threatened in the 80s, as things just kept opening, people running abroad, people marrying foreigners, disco, you know, philosophy, Western philosophy, rational thought, republications, all kinds of crazy movies coming out, all sorts of things. We remember how that ended. It ended in 1989 when students, young people thought, okay, it's time to really overthrow the old regime. And they took to the streets. And you remember what happened. There was Beijing massacre and the party cracked down. And since then, the party has only toughened itself up and reinstated itself more firmly than ever. So in a certain sense, what happened was that, and this is something we need to remember about Xi Jinping and China today, is that when the party gets threatened in a one-party state of a Leninist nature, the party will respond. It won't just say, oh, okay, let's just dissolve ourselves into oblivion and become more democratic. No, that's not the Leninist in the Leninist playbook. It's not in Putin's playbook. It's not in Lukashenko's playbook in Belarus. It's in no Leninist's playbook. And it certainly was not in the playbook of the Chinese Communist Party. What they feared most, they needed reform to get wealthy. But what they feared most was that moment when reform threatened the one-party state. And it did that in 1989. And that was the end of the reform movement.
I think most people who watch this will be familiar, at least on a superficial level, with Tiananmen Square and what happened in 1989. But I'd be remiss if I didn't give you space to detail what happened then and what you think is important to know and remember about that time period in China.
Well, you know, 1989, I think, was probably the most extraordinary time in my life in the sense of being present at a historical moment of consequence. I felt like it was the Russian Revolution, the French Revolution, all of these revolutions thrown into one, and here we were sitting right in the middle of it, watching it. Moreover, 1989, although it took place all over China, the main stage was Tiananmen Square in front of the Forbidden City in Beijing, which was a square built by Mao to outdo Red Square in Moscow. It was the center of the center of the center. So every day, you could just go down to the square, as people called it, and watch the most extraordinary things happen for 7 weeks. It was like a soundstage. And before it happened, Deng Xiaoping had made arrangements with Gorbachev to invite him to Beijing to end the Sino-Soviet rift. So Gorbachev was coming, and there were 1,000 foreign reporters assembling in Beijing to cover that. Instead, they were getting thrown into the middle of Tiananmen Square, and this incredible roiling, boiling, you know, a million people all protesting against their government. And one could see why the leaders were completely freaked out, because this thing had all the qualities of a runaway stagecoach that couldn't be stopped. So it was quite an extraordinary moment, and nobody knew where it would lead. But most people who'd had a little experience were fearful that there would be a response, and a brutal response, because they couldn't imagine that this Leninist one-party state would just say, all right, well, you know, game's over. We give up. And they didn't give up. And they killed untold numbers of people. The party reinstated itself, and it's still in power. And I should say, Xi Jinping is very much a product not of the 80s, but of the 70s when he was a young kid up in the countryside and spurned as the son of a counter-revolutionary. And I mean, that was his formative time, not the 1980s. And he learned early on that to survive, you have to become more red, more Leninist than anybody. Because if your father's a counter-revolutionary, you'll never be accepted completely. So you have to demonstrate your utter and total and excessive loyalty to the party, or you too will be cast out. That's his experience.
Yeah. I want to bring the conversation closer to now. And we're having this conversation just a couple of days into the new year of 2025, and give you some space to talk about how you see the near-term future in China specifically, and with the U.S.-China relationship. And yeah, I know it, just in prepping for this conversation, there are something like 600 million surveillance cameras in China. I think many people know about what has happened with the Uyghurs in Western China. Obviously, Xi is still in power. I just want to put it to you and give your assessment and judgment as best you can about what you think the future might look like. You noted earlier in the conversation that there are these currents running through China that you have personally witnessed, radical transformation that you didn't think were possible, if I understand your perspective correctly. How do you look to the future, and do you think similar massive change is still possible in China in, you know, a year, a 5 year, a 10 year horizon?
Well, to answer your very last question first, is real change possible? Absolutely. One thing that's really important to remember about China is that what you see at the moment is only part of the proposition, because there isn't a kind of open society, free speech. People aren't able to express what it is that they really believe, so they shut up. But that doesn't mean there isn't a deep wellspring of other sentiment that exists below the surface. I mean, this is, I noted earlier, when I was there in the mid-70s, there was no suggestion of the forces that would ultimately arise, and rise with great, you know, sort of volcanic power. And people were surprised that they were still underneath there, sort of waiting to pop back up again. So I think China is a deeply, deeply unresolved body politic and culture, in which there are very powerful contending forces, as there are in any society. But I think in China, they're much more powerfully opposed to each other and conflicting. And so there's even a strong liberal tradition amongst the professional class, the intellectual classes, educated classes, which I think is deeper now than ever after the years of reform and opening and all the interchange with the West, that is slumbering there and will come back and be very surprising to people if the proper conditions arise. Now, the proper conditions certainly have not arisen under Xi Jinping. I think he's very retrograde, a man who believes deeply in sort of big leader culture, and he wants to be a big leader on the level of Mao Zedong, Stalin, Hitler, Mussolini, people like that. So his toolkit was equipped during the Cultural Revolution when he came of age, and it largely includes control. And now we have, you know, control mechanisms unprecedented in history, technologically speaking, that create a techno-autocracy, which is a new game. So it's makes it a little harder to predict the durability of his autocracy. because it's so tricked out with, as you suggested, surveillance cameras, you know, social credit systems, cameras on roads, taking pictures of license plates every kilometer, every time you make a payment on electronic payment system. People know exactly where you are. You buy a plane ticket, train ticket, bus ticket. They know where you're going. In other words, the state knows everything now, which means that its control mechanisms are much more complete and powerful, even in such a vast and still quite poor country in some ways, even though it's accomplished an immense amount in terms of economic development, military development, technological development. So this is a new game. And but new games are never completely new, because they still involve people. And people still want what they always wanted. And in the modern world, as far as I can see, now some people want a dictator, but not that many. And given a real choice, quite few. So these big leader cold tours that we see developing around the world, you know, Erdogan, Orban, Putin, Lukashenko, Xi Jinping, Kim Jong-un, et cetera, the mullahs in Iran. I don't know. I mean, history turns. And these guys are not going to be there forever. And I think that I don't really any longer believe in the nice Hegelian notion of history trundling along teleologically powered towards greater openness and one thing and another, or the Marxist version of that either. But I do believe that fundamentally human beings do not like to be oppressed. That's a powerful engine. And given it a chance, they will express it. But right now, she isn't giving them a chance. But we can see countries that are a little more ambiguous, like Iran. So I don't know. I just say stay tuned. Mm. I've learned after being in China under Mao, nothing is eternal. Not even American democracy, I should say.
Mm. Given your experience with that country, and as you said, stay tuned, so no one knows, but I'm sure you must give this a decent amount of thought. If there is to be change, I've always loved the line that, you know, cemeteries are filled with indispensable men. You know, Xi will die at some point. I would love to know, in your assessment of China, how you think things might change, if it's as simple as a dictator passing away, if it's some other force that you have an intuition could motivate a significant percentage of the population. When you forecast simulations in a more optimistic near-term future for China and making its people more free, how do you think that could occur?
Well, first I should say, I am deeply of the conviction that Leninist societies do have deep roots, and revolutions do leave a tremendous sort of wellspring of influence, even after they may seem to have vanished. So that said, I think China's tendency towards authoritarianism, both traditionally and through its revolutionary experience, is not something we can expect to evanesce very quickly. However, it would not surprise me if after Xi Jinping vanishes, however the good Lord chooses to scythe him down, if we saw something like what we saw after Mao Zedong. A kind of a sigh of relief. Leaders who have been keeping their peace, maybe they've been disenfranchised, defenestrated, locked up even, come back and say, we've had enough of this. We need to try something a little bit more open. Maybe not, full-fledged Jeffersonian democracy, but what Sun Yat-sen called guided democracy, you know, transition. Because those forces exist in China now more than they even did in the 1980s. Because we had the 1980s and the 90s, which are relatively open, it turned out, and we've got all these people showered around the world, educated elsewhere, doing business, doing, you know, cultural interactions. So we are much more globalized, and China is not as quite as easy to lock it down now as it was under Mao. So those forces are there, and I would not be surprised at all if there is an efflorescence of that sort of greater openness in the next round. How we get there, I don't know.
This has been such an honor to do this, and I really appreciate your time and coming on to have this fascinating conversation. I would love to close with just a question about, you know, your own interests in China. And I noted this at the beginning, that very few people in the world have the breadth of experience and firsthand experience with China as you do. And I'd love to close just by asking you why that is, how you explain such an interest in this place, if it's just endless curiosity, if it's, you know, concern for people living under dictatorship. Why is it in your mind that you have dedicated your whole life to understanding this civilization and writing about it, living there? What is it about China that matters to you?
Really interesting question, and I ponder this all the time. You know, first thing I should say is, despite all the horrendous things that have happened in China, there's so many incredibly wonderful people there. I don't know where they came from. I mean, my wife, who passed away a few years ago, would be one. I mean, grew up in utter penury in a real, what President Trump would call, a shithole city. During the cultural, you know, during the Great Leap Forward and the famine, almost died, came to this country as an immigrant, and yet somehow had this amazing ability and was a good person to boot. And you just can't discount China, because it is incredibly energetic, and there are so many wonderful people there. So partially it's that. And partially, I don't know why. I mean, I got stuck on this thing early on, and I couldn't get unstuck. And I don't know, because we all have to do something. And this was the vineyard the good Lord put me into, to toil in. I find it endlessly interesting and fascinating. And I don't know what else to say about it. I don't know if I understand it a whole lot better now, maybe a little better. I mean, history is really important in sort of understanding China, because you can see the different tendencies that have waxed and waned, you know, particularly in the last couple hundred years. And you realize what an incredible contradiction China is. It is in constant motion and play. How it resolves? Well, I don't think it will resolve, but it will continue like a barber pole to turn round and round and round, and things will happen. So stay tuned.
Stay tuned indeed. Orville, thank you so much. This was such a great conversation. I really appreciate you doing this.
No, it was fun. Thank you.